Dental and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement. Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon.
Hello.
It's getting close to the holidays, Bonnie.
Yes, around the corner.
Doing all your plans? You're all together?
Have I made my list? Checked it twice?
Mm-hmm.
Not yet.
Well, we all know first impressions count deeply, but how can we ensure that initial reactions are favorable? We're going to speak with Patty Woods. She's joining us from Decatur, Georgia. She's the author of Snap, Making First Impressions, Body Language, and Charisma. It's very important, and we'll have her on the line shortly.
Okay.
And you've been reading that book, haven't you, Bonnie?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Patty, you there?
I'm here.
Well,
there
hello.
Good, hi.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to make a good first impression on you right now. What do I do to accomplish that?
Be warm and welcoming.
Okay. Did I do that?
Yes.
What else can I do?
In a face-to-face first impression, you can have what I call open body windows at the toes of your feet, the kneecaps, the pelvis, the heart, the throat, the mouth, the eyes,
wait,
the palms of the hands.
Wait, we're getting into the pelvis now?
Well, all the body, all the front of the body are what I term body windows. So in a first impression, one of the things you want to do is make sure that you look approachable and open. So by unfolding your limbs, going forward, leaning forward, and or making sure that you're oriented towards the person, you're opening up your windows.
But I'm on the phone with you now, and sometimes we're meeting somebody for the first time over the phone, or we have a job interview over the phone. So what do we do over the phone to make a first good impression?
You also non-verbally communicate over the phone and use what is called para language, voice tone, tempo, speaking rate, volume level. All the nuances of the voice also communicate. So for example, when somebody says hello on the phone, if we match and mirror them and go hello, they immediately feel comfortable. We like people who are like us. We feel more comfortable and at ease when people have the same rhythm of speaking and pace of communication.
How quickly do we form first impressions of others, and are they always accurate?
First impressions can be highly accurate, 80% or higher in a very brief period of time, measured down to less than 1/300th of a second of interaction, or even in research done with showing tapes and photos, people are able to identify, for example, in videotapes of debates of people running for office, they're able to identify the winner of the debate and even who would win the election based on just short segments of tape. So our ability to read nonverbal communication at a great high degree of accuracy is absolutely astounding. In fact, two people can exchange up to 10,000 nonverbal cues in less than a minute.
Mm.
But you're processing most of those cues in the more primitive brain, what some call the limbic brain, rather than neocortex where language is processed.
Why are handshakes so important, and what's the most important component of a good handshake?
Well, it's so fascinating that one of my most frequently asked questions or line of questions as a professional speaker is how do I shake hands or how do I do it more effectively? The reason handshakes are so important is because it's a greeting ritual which allows us to get in close physical proximity with another person and actually have physical contact in a safe, non-threatening way. And a handshake is actually equal to 3 hours of continuous face-to-face interaction and its ability to establish rapport. In simpler terms, if you shake hands with somebody, it has the same effect as if you've been talking for 3 hours. So if you don't shake hands, it takes 3 hours to get to the same level of rapport. So
what would you base that assumption on, though?
Well, that's actually a research-based finding. And part of that has to do, again, with the space that you're in, that close physical proximity, and you're touching in a safe, non-threatening way. You typically put out your hand historically to show I hold no weapon. And then you make that physical contact to say, okay, I'm touching you, but in a safe way. And then there's all the wondrous complexity of research on touch and its positive benefits if it's done in a safe, non-threatening way. So touch has that capability of changing our chemical state. And so if you get that in an initial interaction, you have a full cascade of chemicals that make you feel better chemically from that person, and assurances that the future of that interaction is going to be a safe, comfortable one. And there's also wonderful research on handshakes that show if you shake hands, you're seen as more likable and more intelligent and more friendly and can persuade others more easily. So there's all sorts of reasons that that simple handshake gives you so much more than what you would think of that little ritual.
You talk about in the book that, say, you're at a cocktail reception, to be sure you hold your drink in your left hand so that when you shake hands with your right, there's no moisture there. That it's,
yes, it's amazing.
It's not
how
one of those yicky things.
It's one of those small things that have such a big impact. I love sharing that kind of information in the book. And it's interesting that by shaking hands, you actually reduce your stress level at the initial part of the interaction. So in the social impression portion of the book, I talk about quite a few different ways, even standing near the door so you can greet people when you're at a networking event to make yourself feel more comfortable and the people coming in feel more comfortable.
How do we know when to do a handshake and when to do a hug? Because in our culture, sometimes hugs are appropriate.
If you go back to that concept of body windows, when somebody wants a hug and you're offering up with your arms open a hug, you're actually showing that all your body windows are open, again, the palms of the hands of the heart being the most basic. So when somebody doesn't want a hug and you are all open, they will tend to start shutting down one or more of their windows. So they'll avert their gaze, they'll bring down their head, they'll turn to the side rather than present the front of their bodies. It's very quickly, you can move then if you care to, from a hug open window to a handshake, which puts your body at a slight angle and protects it.
So what's the biggest mistake one can commit in trying to make a good first impression? What's the biggest mistake we can make?
I think sometimes, and I really make a point of this in the book, if you become self-focused rather than other-focused, so the biggest mistake is thinking, how am I doing? Do they like me? Instead of connecting to the other person and being aware of their communication, their body language, what they're trying to communicate. Because really, the biggest gift you can give to another human being is to understand them. And so all of these different signals are giving you so much information so that you can read to the heart of a person.
Getting back to handshakes, how about cultural differences in
handshake tradition?
There's quite a few.
And it's interesting that over the years, some of those basic ways of greeting, specifically in business interactions, have changed. So, for example, in North American culture, we're taught, make sure you have a firm handshake to show respect. And other cultures, for example, parts of India, some parts of Malaysia, some other Asian cultures, are taught to give a gentle handshake. If the basis of the handshake is to check for weapons, see if you're packing heat, in those cultures, it's, I give you a gentle handshake because I trust you not to be packing heat. So you can have a huge misunderstanding. If you're giving a firm handshake, they give you what you might consider a wimpy handshake, and you're thinking, what a wimp. You're giving them a firm handshake, and they think, what, he doesn't trust me?
Interesting.
Sometimes, so shaking hands with people, it's surprising that someone can be very masculine and they have a handshake. It's sort of like shaking a wilted piece of lettuce or something.
And I think sometimes people don't know the correct pressure to give. And I think also it's important to note that the single most important part of the handshake, and I've done research in North America, Canada, and the UK, is actually the palm-to-palm contact. And that's fairly universal. So one of the reasons we don't like a wimpy handshake, where we're going, oh yeah, gross cooties, when we get a wimpy handshake, is because we're not getting that full palm-to-palm contact that makes us feel comfortable. And that windows that I referred to before, there's a window at the palm of your hand, and when you read the palm of the hand in any interaction with another person, you're looking at the palm and feeling the palm to see, are they going to be open? Are they going to be honest? Can I trust them? Thus the symbolism of, I swear to tell the truth, with your palm up and open.
If you shake hands with a stranger, is it taking a liberty to do the double handshake where one hand goes over the other's back of their hands?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's not too forward.
Right. It's interesting. There's quite a few different cascade, again, differences in the subtleties of that particular double-handed handshake that I call the glove handshake. You mentioned that second hand coming out on top of the person's hand you're shaking. In that case, you're sending a beautifully symbolic message, hey, babe, I'm on top, I have more power. Sometimes you'll see the second hand, when somebody shakes your hand, go underneath yours, in which case they're sending a more message of more support. You might see that. In my research, I see that in physicians. I do a lot of work in the healthcare industry on how to read body language of patients. Or you might see that in a minister or somebody that's in a more caring profession. And then you have the glove handshake that's totally at the side, which says symbolically, hey, babe, you are surrounded. And higher up on the arm with that outside hand is what I call the politician's handshake. And that's the handshake you see at the beginning of the presidential debates, for example.
We have an emailer, Patty. Josh in Wilton Manors wants to know your opinion of the new fad of fist bumps. It seems like a step back from handshakes, but even our president does it now.
Yes, it's interesting. The derivation of that, it actually came to popularity from a TV show on HBO called Entourage, but it's beautifully symbolic. Body language also has a symbolism up versus down that I talk about in the book. So gestures and movements, for example, that come up, especially above, over the head, like that fist bump high in the air that President Obama and Mrs. Obama did. Specifically, you saw that a lot in the first presidential campaign, is symbolizing victory, we want to win, euphoria, joy of winning in battle or after battle. But you also have the fist bumping together that say, it's all about the battle. We're gonna go to war here. So when you see that in a certain subculture, for example, in this case, you see it mostly of 25 and under, it's saying we feel like we have to battle together, but we're going to be victorious in that battle for that high fist bump.
So it's sort of like solidarity and victory. And
like in the 60s with the thumb.
That's right on. Exactly. And as many of those different kinds of handshakes, it's a subculture, it's a tribal ritual to say we're in this group and nobody understands us, but we're together.
Right. It's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. We're speaking with body language expert Patty Wood. She's written Snap, and we're going to take a short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service, off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and online at fairtoremember.com. A Florida Senate resolution endorses the Disabled Veterans Life Memorial Foundation, Inc., raising awareness to design and construct a disabled veterans memorial in our nation's capital. Information at avdlm.org. That's a notice from the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
Well, let's go.
For more than half a century, B.B. King has defined the blues for a worldwide audience. Since he started recording in the 1940s, he has released more than 50 albums, most of which are now considered classics. The Broward Center presents B.B. King in concert for one night only, New Year's Eve at 9 p.m. You can see him live and hear one of the greatest living guitarists at the Broward Center. Tickets at browardcenter.org or 954-462-0222.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and body language expert Patty Wood. She's the author of Snap, Making First Impressions, Body Language, and Charisma. If you'd like to join in, we can take your call. That number is 1-800-520-1055. 743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Bonnie will also take your email. That's radio at WLRN.org. What's next, Bonnie?
Patty, is a first impression forever, or can you ever change one?
Well,
change somebody else's of
yes,
you.
Yes, it's very difficult to change a first impression because they're actually part of our basic survival instinct. But it's possible, and I spend a great deal of time in the book saying specific things that you can do to improve that first impression. So, for example, it's normal when you feel uncomfortable after you've met somebody and you think, oh, I don't think I did make a good first impression, to tend to speed up the interaction. Let's think specifically, for example, a job interview. So you want to rush to get out of there. So one specific thing that you can do to improve your first impression or change it to make it a more positive one is to slow down the conversation and stay connected to the other person, try to get to the pace of that other person, and lean forward and dance with them in that normal way that you would, and shake hands at the end, and shake hands perhaps again. We tend to think of just the first impression, but there's also something called the recency effect, the very last thing you say or do. And that has a profound impact as well on someone's impression. So you want to make sure that you don't give up in an initial interaction if you think you didn't do a good job.
So what would you say would be more important in a job interview, the first impression or the most recent when you're leaving?
Well, the research tends to say that in most job interviews, the interviewer is making the decision of whether or not they're going to hire you within the first 10 seconds. So again, it's very difficult to change it, but it is possible, especially if that interview says, this person's still courageous, and this person's still confident, and this person's still asking me questions, and this person is still connected to me. So all of those give you the opportunity to change or grow into a better first impression.
In today's digital world, sometimes our first impression might become via email. Maybe you can really probably turn somebody off the way you phrase your email or writing in all caps like you're shouting.
Yes, and it's interesting. The techno impressions chapter in my book has received the most interest and the most questions. And in fact, we're thinking about doing another book just on techno impressions. And you're still non-verbally communicating with technology, with any email, with any text. So a really specific example would be now the speed at which we interact with one another so that people expect an instant response. So if you send a text out and somebody doesn't immediately respond to you, there are people, especially in certain generations, that think, well, what's wrong? They're not responsible, or they're not professional, or they don't like me. So you can send an impression that you didn't even intend to send, sometimes because of age or cultural difference in what you think is a reasonable amount of time to respond.
And what about on social networking sites? How does one make a good impression there?
Again, it's interesting. There you have the time concept of how quickly people communicate. It's fascinating that now, instead of picking up the phone and calling different friends and saying, hey, let's meet tonight at 5 o'clock, that you have a whole subculture now that goes out on Facebook and say, hey, let's meet at Ted's Grill at 5 o'clock, and everybody just pays attention to that. And if you have something going on in your life, again, you're not meeting face-to-face necessarily. You're communicating that in a very different kind of environment. There's more anonymity in that environment. You're likely to self-disclose more according to the research in that environment. And obviously, those emotions that you might guard or protect and wait till you know people in order to know whether it's safe to interact, you're sharing much more quickly.
Patty, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
I have two. You can go to Patty, P-A-T-T-I, wood.net, or there's a website totally dedicated to the book, snapfirstimpressions.com, and if you get the book online, for example, a downloadable version, you'll be able to go from a chapter in the book to videos and photos and extra articles that show you more details on shaking hands or any other aspects of first impressions.
Tell us the story of you meeting future audience members for a lecture on a bus while you were kind of disheveled.
Oh, yes. Many years ago, I went right from the gym down to the Atlanta airport, and I wasn't worried. I was getting on a plane, and then I was going to go to a Florida resort to give a presentation, and I got on the plane and got on the bus to go to the resort, and I'm wearing sweatpants, and my hair is all stuck back in a ponytail and looking sort of ultra casual, and then I suddenly realized that everybody on this particular bus is in my audience, going to be my audience the next morning, because they've got the flyer with my much better looking photo on it. So I realized, oh my gosh, I'm setting a first impression before I had thought that I was going to be setting a first impression. And that often happens, you know, you meet somebody in the parking lot in the elevator, and suddenly that's the person that you're about to do business with.
So how did that turn out?
Actually, I used it in the speech because I said, you know, you never know when you're actually starting that first impression. So even in the book, I talk about somebody that went in for a job interview and then basically changed out of their clothes out in the parking lot. They had their bathing suit on underneath to go to the beach after the interview, but the person they were just interviewed by saw them changing in the parking lot and called the guy's dad and said, hey, you sent your son for this job interview, and don't think you knew exactly what he was going to be doing right afterwards.
Ryan, he got caught. So if everyone's trying to make a good first impression, how do you know if somebody's being phony?
One of the four first impression factors is credibility. It's credibility, likability, attractiveness, and power. These are researched factors that we look for when we first meet somebody. So credibility is, obviously, there's a lot of complexity to it, but one of the powerful aspects of credibility is that we feel something when we're being honest, and that comes from our limbic brain where emotions rest. And then we show it nonverbally. Also, that's where nonverbal cues come from, the limbic brain. Then we go over to the neocortex to think of the words that go along with what we're feeling, and just so we can say them. So honesty is feel, show, say. When you're lying, when you're being deceptive, when you're withholding the truth, you have to think about that lie and think of the words, so you're in your neocortex. And then you have to go over and think about the feelings that go with them. So if you're being honest and you say, I just like you so much, you see the facial expression, you hear the nuances in the paralanguage, the voice, and then the words come out. If somebody's lying, they might say, oh, I like you so much, and then give you a stiff smile that comes late. So there's a different rhythm. That's just one of the many aspects that I discuss in the book in terms of how do you know if you can trust somebody when you first meet them.
I suppose experience is a big factor, too. After having done thousands and thousands of radio interviews, I feel like I can size someone up pretty quickly in their first sentence or two.
Yes. And it's interesting that all those nonverbal vocal cues give you so much of an essence of a person's warmth and their likability.
Tell us about that turtle-rabbit continuum and how do we use it?
There are a myriad of different ways that you communicate, and people have a tendency on the continuum of communication style to be somewhere between turtle and rabbit. So rabbits, as you can tell, I'm a rabbit. Rabbits talk really fast, and they tend to be loud. And if they're extreme rabbits, I'm going to show you verbally what that sounds like. So rabbits go really fast, and they don't leave a lot of pauses in the conversation. They hate a pause. In fact, a silence. Oh, my gosh, that makes them so uncomfortable. And then there's moderate rabbits, and then there's, to the other extreme, turtles. And turtles think before they speak and hope others do the same. So in a conversation, you can move anywhere on that continuum. And we actually typically do that naturally.
So if I'm dealing with a rabbit and I'm more a turtle, do I want to speed up my speech to be more like the rabbit?
You would do that normally and naturally if you like somebody, if you want to have rapport with somebody. So you do it, but it's a very brief matching period. And then ideally what happens if you like each other, if you feel comfortable with each other, if you're talking about the same things, that you both feel a certain level of passion, that you'll match and mirror with each other. I call that sort of a dance with your partner when you're in conversation. So I know personally there's friends of mine that I get more rabbit with, and there's friends of mine that bring me to more turtle.
Okay.
We're speaking with body language expert Patty Wood, and she's the author of Snap, Making First Impressions, Body Language, and Charisma. Before we go, Patty, once again, the website where people can learn more about you.
SnapFirstImpressions.com.
Well, thank you very much. You certainly made a good first impression.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Patty.
You take care.
Food and Dining is next.
Back to Topical Currents in just a moment here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM. Thanks for joining us today. Community Smiles is a nonprofit dental clinic for uninsured, low-income children and families. Donations from the community allow them to provide comprehensive dental care. Details at communitysmiles.org, creating smiles since 1946.
The Main Street Players of the Alliance Theater Lab present Carol's Christmas Carol, a brand new holiday celebration, December 15th through the 23rd. After the dismal failure of last year's holiday show, Carol Ginsburg has taken over this year's winter celebration. Will the show go off without a hitch, or will her need to control every aspect make her lose her friends along the way? You can find out at the Main Street Playhouse. Reservations at mainstreetplayers.com.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Our weekly food and dining segment is finally arrived with chef, author, syndicated columnist, my longtime friend Linda Gastenheimer. Linda, the holidays are upon us, but I hadn't thought about how Tuscan culture might celebrate the season, but you have someone with us who can tell us all about it.
Not only Tuscany, but all of Italy. I love Italian.
Boy, do
food.
We have some antipasto here? And
but he's filled the studio, hasn't he?
I didn't know zucchini could taste so good.
Well, it was a zucchini flower.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. Well, I thought it'd be fun to take a trip to Italy, at least take a taste of Italy today for the holidays. And our guest is going to show us the way. He's Chef Giovanni
Sposato.
Giovanni Sposato, okay?
He's the real deal there.
He's the real deal, and he's with us to show us all about it. He's a chef at D'Angelo Pizza Tapas Wine Bar, and that's in Oakland Park. So let's welcome Chef Giovanni.
It's good to be here, and good afternoon, everybody.
Well, we're delighted you're here, especially since you brought us food. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any Italian holiday memories or some questions for Chef Giovanni? Give us a call with your questions or suggestions. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email at radio@WLRN.org.
And also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. You can read Fred Tasker's column today in the Miami Herald, and he's joining us by Skype. Fred, are we drinking today?
Hey, 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 we're always drinking, and we're going to drink some good Italian wine today.
Sounds good to me. Chef Giovanni's got a big smile on his face. Chef Giovanni, Chef Angelo just created, Chef Angelo from D'Angelo, created a dinner at the James Beard House in New York City, Christmas in the Italian countryside. So what did we miss? What were they serving there?
We went, he did a very creative menu, going to from traditional dishes maybe to more modern dishes, we can say, like, you know, when you think of elk tartare.
So that's elk more elk tartare?
Yes.
Okay.
They have elk in Italy?
Yes, we do. Well, it's kind of deer. Maybe it's not exactly elk, but, you know, it's in the same family. And
with some white truffles?
With some white truffles, exactly. Mm. Shaved white fresh truffle from Alba.
Mm-hmm. Boy.
So.
Well, we missed a lot at that dinner, I bet.
And then, you know, they went with some crostone, which is a nice bread, bruschetta, which topped with white anchovies. Mm.
Well, before we go any further, Chef, where are you from in Italy?
I'm from Calabria, southern Italy.
Okay. So what's Christmas like there?
Well, us in southern Italy, mostly what we do, Christmas Eve, it's very important. And Christmas Eve, it's all about fish and seafood.
So do you have the dinner with the seven courses of fish?
Yes.
Yeah.
At least.
All right. So tell us.
At least.
One or two, what are some ideas? Because a lot of people here also have a fish dinner beforehand. So give us some ideas.
So very simple, you know, we have, if we go back in time, you know, it's some places that there wasn't a big, let's say, rich people, what's more poor people. So it starts with very basically a nice spaghetti, just with some anchovies and breadcrumbs. You know, that's what my mother used to make on Christmas Eve as a first
instead
dish.
Of cheese, so it was breadcrumbs.
Yes, yeah. It was just breadcrumbs just to change, you know, like every day, so maybe more cheese on top. And then after that, you know, now it became like you can do with seafood. You know, you can do with squid, you can do with mussels and clams.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe go with some salted cod. As
okay,
a second
some bacala.
Course, some bacala, like we called. And as my mother used to make it with some potatoes and fresh tomato sauce, just a more broth than a sauce, so that it can cook slowly in it and give all the flavor with some bay leaves. And
So a lot of fish dishes.
Yes, and then you can have some maybe fried anchovies, you know, with just a fresh anchovies, so you put in flour and then you deep fry them in a frying pan.
So we're all of us, our mouths are watering. And you brought some wonderful food that we're tasting right now. Tell us, these are zucchini flowers. Tell us what we've got here.
Yes, so this is a zucchini blossom. It's like something that we serve at the restaurant where I work. And this is the time of the year that you can find it all the time.
These are terrific.
And they... thank you. And I thought to bring them because it's something you can have either hot or even
warm. You know, I've never
warm.
Had them cold. And
yes.
Here you took that's the flower of the zucchini. And these are big ones. It's almost the size of my hand. I've never seen flowers that big.
And you know, I'm impressed that you were able to find zucchini flowers in December. How do you do that?
Well, now in Florida, it's a perfect temperature to grow them. And starting in October, you can find them through the holidays easily until April because the temperature is ideal for that.
Fred, it's not snowing here.
It's not snowing
You're in
there.
Michigan.
I guess that's true.
You forgot already. So, but he stuffed it with mozzarella, then you flour them and then you deep fry them. But they were cold and they were just delicious.
Yes, I thought of that because my mother used to cook them and we used to have them all day long, and they always taste perfectly. You
so
know,
you would
like
sneak in the kitchen when she wasn't looking?
Yes.
This is the all-day eating thing?
Yes.
Okay, so then, and then this beautiful antipasto platter. It's got, mortadella and...
Prosciutto and some spicy salami, along with some Italian cheeses like pecorino, and you have some Reggiano. And then
it's Parmesan.
Yes, Parmigiano Reggiano, and
delicious.
And then you have some Asiago cheese, and as you can see, you have green and black olives.
But your olives are beautiful. I mean, these are, and that's a good idea for people during the holidays to just put a huge platter, go to your local delicatessen or your local specialty store, really, and then just fill it up with all these wonderful things and let everyone help themselves. Because I've noticed everybody here in the studio has
been packing.
A lot of people have been coming here and eating this.
Yeah, it really makes you feel welcome when you go to somebody's house and they've got this huge plate of food like that out for you. Makes me feel welcome anyway.
It sure does. And then you made something special in the center of this. Now tell us what you made.
Okay, that's homemade marinated eggplants. That's one of my recipes from Calabria. We're very strong in marinated vegetables or mushrooms. And these are just streams.
You make them in strips.
Yes.
But thin, like spaghetti strips.
A little thicker? A little thicker, yes.
Right.
And then you blanch them in a mixture of water and vinegar.
Why the vinegar?
The vinegar, first of all, it's to keep your eggplant nice and white, you know, it doesn't turn black,
okay. The
color. And then the second, it's like you're conservative, you know, you're not putting anything artificial. So that's what you're going to keep your vegetable long time. That's why everything marinated, that's with
so how long in advance could you make this, the eggplant?
You can have them all winter without putting in the refrigeration. What do? You just, after you blanch them, you put it, let's say, in a jar, and you put some oil, and you cover it with oil, and they stay there.
Just oil and vinegar?
Yes.
Oh, no, there's something else in there. There's something else. What am I tasting?
There is some mint, chopped mint, some garlic.
I think that's, and garlic for sure.
Yes.
I think it's interesting that we never think of mint being Italian. But a lot of Italians put mint into their recipes, and that you can find wild mint there, actually.
Yes, and where I come from, there is a lot of mint that just grows in
Calabria.
In the fields, yes, and so you use it, like oregano. We use a lot of oregano because you can find it in the mountains.
Just growing wild.
There, just growing wild, mm-hmm. And it's not the same flavor when you pick it up in the fields.
You know, that's what I love about Italy, is that each region still has their own regional cuisine, and it's so good in each area that you go to. And that's wonderful. Now, my favorite part you've got here, those little boxes. What are they in these little boxes?
Okay, this is another Italian tradition. We have a panettone, which is a holiday cake, we can call it. And we have a pandoro. So the difference.
So you have a panettone and a pandoro.
Yes.
And what's nice about you, lots of times panettone is in a great big box and kind of gets stale before you eat it all. But these are in little, like individual size.
Yes, we got them this year. It's like, I find it's a good idea because sometimes you have to open a big box and you don't feel like, and you have a big cake in front of you and you need people to share. And this one, you can have about two people and just have a cappuccino, yeah.
What's the difference between a panettone and a pandoro, did you say?
Yes, panettone has some raisins and has some candied fruit in it.
Mm-hmm. And a little rum, you think?
Yeah, a little rum.
Yeah,
yes,
there's a lot of rum.
Yeah.
I tasted that.
A little rum, and instead of like pandoro, it's just a plain vanilla cake. That's the difference.
Well, that's wonderful. What are some of the other Italian desserts you'd have at Christmas?
If I take it from southern Italy, or maybe we go to Tuscany, they do this merengue alla panna, and us in the south, we do, it's a lot with the fried stuff, so we do this little, I can say in Calabrese if you want. It's a turditi, for the ones in the Italian Calabrese, they know. It's just a wine cookie, white wine cookie, you know. You deep fry, and then you do it with, the figs. We cook the figs, and then you get like a honey or melasse out of it.
Honey, figs, and cookies.
Mm. And
on that note, we're going to take a break here while I drool. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Chef Giovanni Sposata about an Italian Christmas. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM, and we're streaming online at WLRN.org. The Technion, Israel Institute of Technology, is often described as the engine that drives Israel's high-tech economy. Technion graduates helped develop the Iron Dome defense system and many other life-saving technologies. Learn more at ats.org.
Salute to Vienna, New Year's Concert 2013, returns to the Kravis Center for the Performing Arts on Sunday, January 7th at 8 p.m. Hungarian maestro Andrés Dejak leads the new cast featuring European singers performing operetta excerpts and dancers from the Vienna Imperial Ballet performing Strauss waltzes and polkas in costume. You can party like it's 1899. Tickets and information at kravis.org.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Chef Giovanni Sposata, and he's the chef at D'Angelo Pizza, Tapas, and Wine Bar, and that's in Oakland Park on Federal Highway. And he's been giving us some wonderful tips about Christmas or holidays in Italy. And so now it's dinner in minutes time. So here's a quick and easy dinner in minutes. Right. You're eating yourself happy today, everyone. I mean, Chef brought us all of this wonderful food. And now, this is real simple. It's balsamic glazed steak with linguine and fresh tomato and basil, and that makes it a very colorful holiday-looking pasta. Yeah. So I use skirt steak, but any quick cooking steak can be used. You sauté the steak for a couple of minutes. 3-4 minutes aside, it depends how thick it is. But if you like it medium rare, look for 145 degrees. If you want it medium, look for 160 degrees. And then once the steak's cooked, remove it. Let it rest a few minutes while you put some balsamic vinegar into the skillet with a few onions and let that cook down to a syrup and put it over the steak.
A little deglazing then.
Deglazing, and it's so easy and simple. But meanwhile, you cook the pasta, and into the pasta water, you just at the end, before just about 2 minutes before the pasta is finished, you put in some tomatoes, and then you take it out, and olive oil, a little basil, salt and pepper.
You put tomatoes in the pasta water?
Just for a minute, or you know what you could even do, which would even be very nice and fresh, is just put the olive oil, tomato, basil in a bowl, and then put the hot pasta into that, and then just toss it. And chef's saying, yes, that would be better. Okay,
yeah.
Good. And then, and it's done. And that recipe is at dinnerinminutes.com. And another holiday quick and easy recipe, how about some steak au poivre with pepper and mushroom sauce? That's in today's Miami Herald. So either one, go to dinnerinminutes.com and you'll be able to access either recipe. And by the way, all of my columns, my dinners, fit the government guidelines for nutritional analysis. So you're not going to break your calorie bank.
Perfect.
And thank you. And are you enjoying it? Yeah, the chef at least is enjoying my food. Mm-hmm. You guys are so
indeed
spoiled.
Piping hot today too, Linda.
Right. Well, please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer, or on Facebook. Fred Tasker, are we drinking today?
Oh, yes, we are. This is bringing back very fond memories for me because I was lucky enough to spend Christmas in Tuscany in Florence a few years ago, and I can tell you the dining was just absolutely great. On Christmas Eve at a restaurant, we had steak Florentine, which was about a 2-pound steak grilled with garlic and rosemary.
A 2-pound steak for you?
Well, I had a doggy bag. And earlier in the year, we had roasted wild boar at the Bonfi Winery, and that was just fabulous.
That's very popular in Tuscany.
Yeah, I guess the boar are a problem there, and once a year they allow them to go out and shoot them because they're vegetarians and they like grapes, so they try to cut down on the population a little bit, and visitors like me benefit from it.
So the wild boar like the grapes?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
And with
drunken boar?
Well, they're grapes. They're not fermented at that point,
okay.
Hope. But anyway, with such great Tuscan food, you want a Tuscan wine, of course. And there's a new Tuscan winery in town here called Brancaia. It's spelled B-R-A-N-C-A-I-A. And it makes super Tuscan wines, which means they take the usual Sangiovese grape that makes Chianti, and they supplement it with international varieties like Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and that sort of thing. And this creates big, powerful, really fabulous wines. Brancaia makes one called Il Blu, B-L-U, for $85. And if that's a little steep, they have one called Tre, spelled T-R-E, and that's just $23. And this would be good for most big, bold Christmas entrees: roast suckling pig, roast goose, duck, pheasant, roast beef with Yorkshire pudding.
Ooh, that sounds good.
You're making us all even hungry all over again.
Pheasant, it's another popular dish, in Tuscany.
Yeah. And if you serve fish, if you're talking about the seven fishes or chicken or other white wine dishes, you could try a 2010 Stone Street Chardonnay from California. That's $40 a bottle. It's a fabulous wine. And if that's a little steep, you could take a 2011 Handcraft Chardonnay, also from California, at $12 a bottle. And in any case, be sure to raise the proper toast. As Tiny Tim would say, God bless us, everyone.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Very interesting. What wines are you serving in
your
restaurant?
He ties Wild Boar and Tiny Tim together.
Drunken Wild Boar.
How's that for the Prince of Blends?
What wines are you serving with your pizza at your pizza restaurant?
We have a variety from Italy, from north to south. And of course, since we're talking about Tuscany, we still have traditional wines from Tuscany, like Chianti, like Brunello di Montalcino.
All right. So now you have pizza at your, and you told me it's like sort of an Italian style pizza. So tell me what your pizza's like.
Actually, you can't get, I think, more Italian than that. It's a wood oven pizza. It's not coal fire. It's really wood fire pizza. And that's the way I learned a long time ago in Italy. And
so you fire up the oven with wood?
With wood,
not
yes.
Coal.
Okay.
Is it thin crust?
It's a thin crust, and it's nice and crunchy outside and nice and moist inside. It's very thin, yes. That's the way it's supposed to be when you cook it in a wood oven, because it cooks so fast. It cooks in a 4 or 5 minutes frame.
And what else do you put on top? What makes it Italian? Because we tend to put anything on a pizza.
Yes, but makes it Italian, basic ingredients, like the sauce, it's very good, from San Marzano tomato, and of course the best cheeses. You have fresh mozzarella cheese, which makes a big difference, and then the fresh basil, extra virgin olive oil. That's what the secret ingredients.
I'll bet you don't use ham and pineapple, right?
actually, we do once in a while put on special, because there is a request for that, and we open to.
If people ask,
we'll
do that.
Do it when I have the pineapple.
That's very accommodating of you.
Well, the thing is, but in Italy, they don't overload the pizza. Their ingredients are so fresh and wonderful that you don't need a lot on it. Just a very, very good, fine ingredient. So tell everybody, where is this restaurant?
The restaurant is situated in Oakland Park on Federal Highway. It's close to Commercial Boulevard.
And so they can Google what? Pizza?
Pizzadangelo.com.
Okay. So pizza, D-A-N-G-E-L-O.
I'm going to have to try that place.
D apostrophe?
Yes.
A-N-G-E-L-O.
Yes.
.com.
I don't know if there's an apostrophe in the
Yes, there is on the D. Yes, the
there
apostrophe.
Is. Okay. Well,
Angela.
Just Google it somehow and you'll find it. You'll find it. So now tell me something. If we wanted to travel in Italy, which I love to do because the food's so good there, but where are the best food areas to go? What would you suggest?
I think you have best areas everywhere you go in Italy, from south to north. My suggestions, if you want to really taste the local specialties, just get out of the big towns and go to a nice trattoria in those villages. You really find the food that the way they make it, home style.
So get away from the tourists and you'll be all right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, and also, you have, you're from Calabria, and I think that's an area that most people don't go to the south of Rome.
Yes, if you want to see really panoramic, it's from centuries. You go in Calabria, there is a lot of them, because a lot of places not built on, and that's what you see in Calabria. It's more rustic,
Well, that sounds wonderful. It's been another very, very tasty week.
Indeed.
Thank you.
What a spread the chef brought.
Oh, ho. And dinner in minutes.
Zucchini flowers. I've never had those before.
You haven't? Oh, well. Okay. Chef Giovanni Sposada, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for this very delicious food.
Yes, thank you.
His restaurant is located on Federal Highway in Oakland Park, and it's called, the name of it?
Pizza D'Angelo, Tapas and Wine Bar.
And Fred gets his snow shovel out.
Yes, I do. We're getting 14 inches here today. It's coming down like crazy right now.
Enjoy, Fred.
We're all laughing at you,
Fred.
You have to love
I'm
it.
I'm envious.
Bonnie and Joe, you ate very well today.
Thank you, Linda.
And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Next week, we'll be talking with Marguerite Mondavi. We'll be celebrating New Year's Mondavi style. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, as well as discussions. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our website, new and improved, WLRN.org. And tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We'll be off for the holidays, but return for Boxing Day. That's the 26th, with a program about how to cope with unemployment and finding a new job when you're over 50. And today's calendar, on this day in 1881, 131 years ago, the birth of baseball sage Branch Rickey. He started the minor league farm system, opened the door for Jackie Robinson, and drafted Roberto Clemente. And on this day in 1946, 66 years ago, the film It's a Wonderful Life premieres in New York City. Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, Lionel Barrymore, and of course, Clarence the Angel. And one more, on this day in 1968, 44 years ago, the death of author John Steinbeck at age 66 in New York. Of Mice and Men, Grapes of Wrath, Cannery Row, The Pearl. And so we leave with a thought from Branch Rickey, the Mahatma, who as a catcher once allowed 13 stolen bases in a single game. Still a record. Quote from Rickey, "Man may reach the outer reaches of the universe, he may solve the very secret of eternity itself, but for me, the ultimate human experience is to witness the flawless execution of a hit and run." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
This is 9-